My name is Bill Erbrock. I'm in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. This is the fourth session this week in which we have been dealing with stories from the Old Testament that image God's suffering, and particularly that image women's suffering. In fact, sometimes women not only betrayed by men, but seemingly even betrayed by God, so another level. And we've been using as our helper and guide during the week the book by Phyllis Trible entitled Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. Today we're looking at A Woman of Bethlehem in Judges 19, a lesson that I've characterized, But There Was No Answer. Phyllis Trible entitles her chapter on this woman, An Unnamed Woman, The Extravagance of Violence. I've asked Ray McKeever to come in and lead us in song at the beginning of this session, maybe a song that will give us some healing in advance, because this is a story of rather unrelieved violence. So I'll let you lead us. Sure.
Okay, we're going to sing out of a book here called Everflowing Streams, edited by Ruth Duck and Michael Bosch. Page number 73. To do. Sometimes I Wish.
Number
73. Sing along boldly.
Sometimes I wish my eyes hadn't been open. Sometimes I wish I had no longer seen all of the pain and the hurt and the longing of my sisters and me as we try to be free. Sometimes I
Just in case that didn't come out real clearly on the tape for words, I'd like to read it again. In fact, why don't we have the women read the first stanza together?
Sometimes I wish my eyes hadn't been opened. Sometimes I wish I could no longer see all of the pain and the hurt and the longing of my sisters and me as we try to be free.
We'll let the men read the second stanza. Sometimes I wish my eyes hadn't been opened. Just for an hour, how sweet it would be not to be struggling, not to be striving, but just sleep securely in our slavery. Women?
But now that I see with my eyes, I can't close them, because deep inside me, somewhere I still know the road that my sisters and I have to travel. My heart would say yes, and my feet would say go.
And together.
Sometimes I wish my eyes hadn't been opened, but now that they have, I'm determined to see that somehow my sisters and I will be one day the free people we were created to be. That somehow my sisters and I will be one day the free people we were created to be.
Well, that's a powerful song. Thanks for choosing that one, Ray. I suspect that everybody that ever gains any amount of insight feels this way from time to time. Sometimes more than just from time to time, right? You wish your eyes hadn't been opened. That's that old proverb, ignorance is bliss. And if I didn't know these things, well then of course I wouldn't have to do anything about them. So it's a wonderful excuse for inactivity to plead ignorance. And those of us who were at the session this morning on male identity, Ray and Dave Anderson gave us a real gift in that session too. I felt that session needed to go on for several more hours. And, all we had to do was change the word here to brothers, and the men were having some of the same problems. And there's a real sense of unity, I think, that's been developing in some of these sessions, and it's been surprising how they've overlapped.
Just for reference, I was either between that song or this song singing. There's another real good song here that, for others, this book is for sale in the bookstore too. And but there are some wonderful songs about women's struggles in particular. Number 18, Hearts Open Slowly, that's a real nice one too.
You want to sing that one too, yeah?
Can I do that one too?
Oh, sure, why not?
It's a little tougher one to sing. Is why
don't we let you sing?
Why?
Sing for us, come on.
Well, I don't know it that well. I mean, we could do it. So
people who listen to the tape someday will appreciate this.
Okay. Well, everyone sing at least the chorus for sure, and try the verse if you can, okay? But it's another song of, I think, hope and...
Hearts open slowly, so slowly, unfold like the flower, sing the songs of the dove. Hearts open surely, so surely, milk and honey will flow for the hungry to love. Mother of all, we deny you the power to move us to deep rage, but somehow we know how you suffer. Children are hungry and scarred by the days of fevers and famines. We need you to save hearts. Open slowly, so slowly, unfold like a flower, sing the songs of the dove. Hearts open surely, so surely.
Actually, I never even noticed that those were over there.
Well, that's some music to bring us together before we look at what truly is a terrifying text. I guess when I've read the Old Testament, this has always been to me the most terrifying anywhere. Perhaps I'm not exactly sure why. There's some other places that are also pretty awful. Where people are being annihilated, and there are some terrifying judgments in some of the prophetic oracles. But perhaps it's because you feel the incredible anonymity of this woman. 2 days ago we looked at Hagar. She at least had a name in the story. She wasn't always called by name in the story, but it was there. And there was some guarantee that her name would live on, because even though she was, you know, she ended up in the wilderness, having been thrown out by Sarah and Abram, she at least had promises of some progeny. She was still going to bask in the glory of her son, but nevertheless she had a son, and there was a promise that there would be a future. And in some way, God has heard Hagar, even though in the story he didn't hear her that well, because, as you know, she has become an important figure in Islam, because she happened to be the ancestress of the Arabs. And at least in the Muslim religion, she is remembered with great affection. And yesterday, too, there was at least some mitigation in that story of the rape of Tamar by her half-brother Amnon. At least her brother Absalom tried to do the right thing by her, and at least her name lived on in the niece. Right, when Absalom had a daughter who was beautiful like the aunt, he named her Tamar. And she at least has a name that way too, This is a woman who has no name whatsoever. And she is, in this story, really nothing more than an object all the way through. I'd like to read a few things from Phyllis Trible. If you have a book, you may follow along with me. I'm going to read a little bit from pages 65 and 66, and then again from pages 80 and 81. Trible says, "The betrayal, rape, torture, murder, and dismemberment of an unnamed woman is a story we want to forget, but are commanded to speak. To hear this story is to inhabit a world of unrelenting terror that refuses to let us pass by on the other side." The allusion to the story of the Good Samaritan, of course. Cast of characters, top of page 66. In this story, the cast of characters is predominantly male. There's a Levite, his attendant, a Na'ar, a young man or an attendant, a father, an old man, and a group of men. Of the two females, a concubine is central, and a virgin daughter receives scant attention. All these people are nameless in this particular story. The men do speak, even the attendant, but the women say nothing. So it is a fact, you could argue, well, nobody is named in this story. True enough. But at least the men do speaking, and they do most of the acting. The women are simply pawns. If you go over to page 80 and 81, another word from Phyllis Trible at the bottom of page 80. "Of all the characters in Scripture," Trible says of this unnamed woman, "she is the least. Appearing at the beginning and close of a story that rapes her, she is alone in a world of men. Neither the other characters nor the narrator recognizes her humanity. She is property, object, tool, and literary device." You know, in some of these other stories, at least the narrator had mitigated it in some ways. "Without name, speech, or power, she has no friends to aid her in life or mourn her in death." In fact, as an aside, I'm sure you noted in the story that there was no God who came to her aid either. Trible goes on, "Passing her back and forth among themselves, the men of Israel have obliterated her totally. Captured, betrayed, raped, tortured, murdered, dismembered, and scattered, this woman is the most sinned against." The story, of course, is part, again, of a larger whole. It actually belongs to a set of three stories at the end of the book of Judges. All of the stories deal with the tribe of Benjamin, and this is the beginning of that three-story segment that explains how a falling out developed between the tribe of Benjamin and the other tribes in Israel and the ensuing violence. And we'll come back to that at the end, but at least you should remember that it's part of this larger segment. As far as literary design is concerned, Phyllis Trible identifies two major scenes with an intro, an interlude, and a conclusion around them. The introduction is in the first two verses of chapter 19, where the two main characters are introduced to us, the Levite and his concubine. And of course, they're introduced as being very different in terms of who they are, what they represent. Trible says on page 66, "A Levite has an honored place in society that sets him above many other males. A concubine has an inferior status that places her beneath many other females." So not only do we have the disparity between a man and a woman, but we have an extra disparity between a man who has some status in his society and a woman who has even less status than, say, you know, a regularly married woman. Legally and socially, she is not the equivalent of a wife. She's virtually a slave, secured by a man for his own purposes. and the grammar and syntax of the introducing or opening sentence exploit this inequality. A man, a Levite, sojourning in the remote hill country of Ephraim, took for himself a woman, a concubine from Bethlehem of Judah. He is subject, she is object, he controls her. How he acquired her, we don't even know. That he owns her is certain. We then come to the first main scene, which is in verses 3 through 10, and consists of three small episodes. A journey of this master to Bethlehem because his wife has run away back home. Has run away back home. And we're not sure why she ran away back home. One tradition says that she had been unfaithful to him. Another tradition simply says she was angry at him. And so we're not sure who was unfaithful to whom or who was mistreating whom. For whatever the reason, she ran back home. And of course, he wants to get her back. The second episode here talks about the visit between the man and this concubine's father. And there's an interesting literary device that Tribble points out, and that is that he stays with the father, his father-in-law, for 3 days, and then for a day and a night, and then for a day before he departs. The time periods are shrinking, 3 days, a day and a night, a day. But as the time periods shrink, the story gets longer. The 3 days are barely described. The day and the night are described in a little bit more detail. And the single day is described in the most detail. So you have a real nice device of giving you a sense of delay. Because he wants to go back home, but his father-in-law is delaying and showing him all this hospitality. And of course, it's the delay that's important for what's to follow. Question.
Bill, I was reading this out of another, it was a Good News Bible or something. Mm-hmm. And the RSV says, then her husband arose. It keeps referring, and the other Bible says, the man. But they still speak of father-in-law. And I get really confused with the designations in there. Because she was his concubine, did she consider him her husband?
And I think it's probably not absolutely clear simply from the words. There were various arrangements for concubinage.
Yeah.
And, you get the impression at the beginning of the story that she means something to him.
Yeah.
And the word for, for father-in-law gives you the impression, well, maybe there was something. She at least had some sort of legal status. Maybe he had had a wife formerly and had some children by the other wife, and to secure their inheritance, she wasn't made a full wife. You're simply not told. But as the story develops, whatever sort of status that may have given her some, whatever sort of contract may have given her some status, as the story develops, it's fairly clear that she loses all status whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. It's somewhat difficult as you're reading through to make sense of that.
And they keep explaining it to us, and his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay. I mean, there's always a little explanation stuck in there. And
yes.
Out.
Well, did you notice that during this whole time that they're together, the husband had gone to speak from his heart to her, it says in Hebrew. When he gets to the house, does he ever talk to her? No. All the talking is between the husband and the girl's father, whether or not, and whatever sort of father-in-law he is legally. And they do the eating and the drinking, and the girl just, she's not really a woman even. She's just whatever she is in this situation. Anyway, after this nice time that the husband or master, however you to understand him, has. You notice Tribble always uses master in her translation. The Lord and Master. They finally close off this episode with a departure. He rose up and departed in verse 10. Then you have a small interlude in verses 11 through 15, the beginning of 15, where they're on their way back home. They're leaving now they're going back up north towards Ephraim. He had gone south to get her in Bethlehem, and they're going back home. And on the way, they pass what in the future is going to become Jerusalem. This is not an Israelite city yet. It's called Jebus in this story. And he has with him, it says, a couple of saddled asses and his concubine and another slave. And you notice, at this point also, who does the talking. Now he talks with the slave. She still doesn't get a word in edgewise. And Phyllis Tribble says she's not much more worth anything than the asses. And you wonder why he bothered to go and speak from his heart to her. He hasn't spoken a word to her yet. And they debate on whether or not they should spend the night in this foreign city because it's getting dark. And they finally come to the conclusion, the master says, no, we won't go into this foreign city. We've got to go into an Israelite town. We'll go on at least as far as Gibeah or Ramah, something like that. Let's see what we can find, how far we can get. And sure enough, they make it as far as Gibeah, which belonged to the tribe of Benjamin. Now, of course, that sets us up for what's to follow. I mean, his choice was, it would appear, a wise choice. Let's not go into a foreign city. We might be abused as strangers. Let's make sure we go into a town of our own, right? And that adds the irony to what happens. So now we come to the second major scene. And once again, it's a scene that has to do with something going on in a house. In that first major scene, if we want to call him son-in-law, goes to the father-in-law's house, and they have this fine hospitality. Now we've got them in another situation where once again they're going to be received. And you have this interesting play in this whole second scene about what goes on outside and what goes on inside. And that's a major literary device in this second major scene. Because they're first of all outside, right? They come into the town and it's getting darker and darker and nobody takes them in for the night until finally an old man who had been working in the field comes in, and he doesn't even belong to this town. It just so happens that he's a fellow Ephraimite that's sojourning here, and he is the only one who welcomes him. And in fact, we're not even sure how terrifically excited he is to welcome him, because the Levite sort of makes sure that he'll get a welcome. He says, we're passing through, but I've got everything I need. All we really need is a place for the night. I've got straw and provender for my asses. I have food for the rest of us. All we need is a place to stay. You don't even have to feed us. And the old man says, shalom, peace be with you. I'll care for all your wants. He really is very hospitable. So you don't have to worry about that. I not only have a place, I'll take care of everything that you need. But don't spend the night in the square. And we sort of say to ourselves, well, is he worried about that? Or is he just being solicitous as a nice host? And so now they've gone inside. And as they are inside, there are the men of the city on the outside who begin to beset the house round about and desiring that this foreigner be brought out again, right? Bring out the man who went in to your house that we may know him. I think most of you know that Hebrew idiom, to know, can mean to know in a sexual manner. So they want to abuse him. And the man, who is the master of the house, goes out to them and tells them they shouldn't act wickedly that way because the man came in to his house. They shouldn't do such a vile thing. He says, instead, you can have my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out. And you can ravish them and do whatever you feel like it. But don't do anything like that against this man. And the men wouldn't listen to him. And so you have this climactic verse 25, and Tribble points out very carefully the Hebrew there, where it says, so the man seized his concubine and pushed to them outside. It doesn't even say her. He seized his concubine and pushed to them outside. So he doesn't even wait for the argument to finish between these people and just pushes out whatever it happens to be in front of him to push out. So now she's out. And they knew her and abused her all night till the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as the morning appeared, the woman came, fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. Tribble says, isn't it ironic that in verse 26 of this story is the very first time you ever hear of this woman doing something? Everything else in the story up to this time has been done to her, except for the fact that she ran home, I guess. She's done, the only other action she actually did on her own was to go home in verse 2. Now she's finally doing something, and what she's doing is, you know, dragging herself after the abuse. Yes?
It's also the first time she's referred to as a woman in the RSV. She's out previous to this time she's referred to as a girl.
Yes, or as a concubine. That's right. And Tribble says, how ironic, because it's precisely at the point where now she's lost all status whatsoever, she actually does something. She comes and she falls down. And Tribble says, and of course there's a double irony there too, because falling down is simply, you know, one more way of indicating her servile position. Tribble says, her physical state at this point embodies her servile position. Another thing that Tribble notes is how you've got three or four times that it mentions light and dawn here. It's a crime that was done at night, but the light of day exposes the full horror. So then we have at the conclusion of this central scene another little segment at the doors of the house from the inside. The master rose up in the morning, obviously on the inside, and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way. Oh, but look, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. The way the story is told, you wonder whether he had even intended to take her along with him. Almost as an afterthought, whoops, she's still there. Now what do I do? So what does he do? Well, obviously, he does what he had originally intended to do, right? He speaks tenderly to her. Yes, you all know the answer. He does not speak. He doesn't speak to her heart at all. He says, get up! Let's go. Do you remember yesterday in the Tamar Amnon story? After Amnon had had his way with her, he said, get up, get out. Something like that. The same thing. She's unable to do so. It says, this to me is the most poignant one in the story, and that's why I chose it to title my session. But there was no answer. And of course, the question is, at this point now, why was there no answer? Get up and let's go, but there was no answer. Is she dead or alive? The Greek Bible, remember that's the Bible that the Greek-speaking Jews used in Alexandria, so it was as authoritative as the Hebrew one that was used in Israel. The Greek Bible says, for she was dead, and hence makes the men of Benjamin murderers as well as rapists and torturers. The Hebrew text, on the other hand, that was the text that was in vogue in Palestine among the Palestinian Jews, says nothing about that. It's silent, allowing the interpretation that this abused woman is yet alive.
oppressed, tortured, she opens not her mouth. Her silence, be it exhaustion or death, Tribble goes on, deters the master not at all. What he set out to do in the light of the morning, he does. Putting her on the donkey, the man rose up and he went away to his place. Then we come to the conclusion. Yes, please. This is the power, it seems to me, of much of the storytelling in the Hebrew Bible. There are so many things that are left unsaid. Those of you who are old Marshall McLuhan fans from some years ago, you know, it's the difference between a cool medium and a hot medium. You know, when it's hot, you tell them everything. It's what so many of us like to do when we're teaching our children about life and especially about religion. And it's what I think so many teachers like to do. I find myself often doing that. It's what I think is just infects the church. Ministers always want to do it. You know, tell them everything as soon as you can. You know, you want to make sure they memorize it all so they don't get it wrong. Now, whereas in Hebrew scriptures, it's very different. You know, the medium is cool. And as often as not, there are hints, there are insinuations, there are allusions, but you're left to interpret maybe this, maybe that. And it's fairly clear to me that many of those Jewish people living in Greece, in Alexandria, in the couple of centuries before and around the time of Jesus, when they translated their Hebrew Bible into Greek, some of those translators just couldn't stand it. And so every once in a while they had to put it in, and this was a place where they couldn't stand it, the ambiguity. So they put, for she was dead, and that explains it. Or remember yesterday we had that ambiguity with Amnon and Tamar. David got very angry. Mm-hmm. And the Greek rabbi says, because he was upset because Amnon was his firstborn. You know, the young man had gotten into big trouble now. You know. Let's make it clear to our readers why he got angry, you see. The original storyteller, or writer at least, or editor, leaves an ambiguity in there, I think, purposely. Because it's only when you have those kinds of ambiguities in the telling of stories, or in great art of any type, also the plastic arts, that you call forth really involved responses from your viewer, or your listener, or your reader, or whatever. When everything is there, it's not very, it really isn't that interesting. You're left out. You're not drawn in. Well, what a powerful statement, you know. And there was no answer. Why? Because she was dead? Or because she was exhausted and as good as dead? Or is she so devastated that at this point she chooses not to answer? Tribble doesn't say that, you know. But I think sometimes silence can be a protest. Now what is she to say? He's never said a word to her. What is there for her to say to him in a situation like this? The story comes to a swift conclusion in verses 29 and 30. He entered his house and he took the knife. In Hebrew it says, he took the knife. And Tribble says, amazing. There's only one other place in all of Scripture where anyone ever is said to take the knife. It's in the story of the near sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. Where it also says of Abraham, he took the knife. Of course, in Isaac's case, he was spared. In this case, when he took the knife, he seized his concubine. He divided her up limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Lay it to heart, take counsel, and speak. Well, you notice again the word, he seized his concubine in 29 in Hebrew. It's that word chazak. It's the same one that was used in verse 25 when he was all upset and thought his life was in danger. He seized her and pushed outside. Here again, he seizes her. The use of that verb is to underscore the sense of violence. It's exactly the same verb that we saw yesterday in the story of Tamar and Amnon, when he was feigning illness and she baked the bread for him and got close and says, he seized her. Why did he dismember her? Do you know any other story in Scripture where this happens? You'll read a story someday in 1 Samuel 11 during the time of Saul, before Saul had become king, or around the time he was becoming king. And there was a group that was being threatened in Israel. And what he did is he took a yoke of oxen and he cut them up in 12 pieces and sent them out. And he said, this is what will be done to those who don't come to aid us. Do you also remember a story back in Genesis 15, where when Abraham received his promise that he was to have descendants, the God said to him he was to take animals and cut them in parts and put the parts on two sides. And then in his dream, Abraham saw the divine fire walk through the parts as it was giving a promise to him. The implication being God saying, if I don't keep my promise to you, may I become slaughtered like these animals. That was a way of making solemn promises in the ancient world. You slaughtered animals and magically walked between them, bringing a curse upon yourself if you didn't keep your word. Evidently something like this, something similar to that. It doesn't appear to be exactly the same. But he's sending the parts out to show the horror of it all, but in effect also to say, and if we don't do something about this, it's going to happen to everybody. Tribble also notes something very unusual that you'd never see in the English, and that is in the Hebrew, there's a nuancing on this statement where it says at the very end, all who saw it, the it there in Hebrew is feminine. Is very unusual. You could translate that, all who saw her said. She has not been seen. She has not been done from the day that the people of Israel came up to this day and so forth. A very strange grammatical usage and a sense of kind of, you know, at least giving her some kind of last statement as she goes off the scene in the mouth of those who are involved here. Well, that's the literary design of the story. We've already underscored some of the leading motifs in the story, but I want to talk to two of them because I think they're very important. The first one, of course, we've mentioned is the speaking to the heart. It doesn't show up always in the English translations. It comes out something like speak tenderly to her or whatever. But Tribble has a very fine note on that on page 67. He says, he went after her. This is right at the beginning. Remember when she left him and fled to her father's house? He went after her, says the Hebrew, to speak to her heart, to bring her back. The words to speak to the heart connote reassurance, comfort, loyalty, love. In other passages where this phrase describes the action of a man toward a woman, she may be either the offended or the guilty party. For example, after he had raped Dinah, the daughter of Leah and Jacob, Shechem found himself drawn to her. It says, he loved the young woman and spoke to her heart. Remember, the heart in Hebrew is the place where your rationality resides. So it doesn't merely mean that he's doing sweet nothings in the ear. It means he wants to do some persuasion, but it's obviously loving persuasion. There's another one in Hosea where it says, Yahweh, the faithful lover, promises to restore his faithless bride Israel by bringing her into the wilderness and speaking to her heart in Hosea 2. So Tribble says, the Levite's desire to speak to the heart of his concubine indicates some love with her. He's seeking reconciliation. I would even go further. I would say that indicates some sense that she's an intelligent woman. To have a heart means you have intelligence in Hebrew.
You just push it down one. We think with our heads and often feel with our hearts. The Hebrews think in their hearts and feel down in their guts, which to my mind makes a lot more sense in some ways. But she's to be a woman of intelligence. Well, then the irony when the story goes on, he never does speak to her. In fact, nobody ever speaks to her until he finally says, get up, we got to go. And she's no longer in a position to get up and go. And then to drive the nail in the coffin, as it were, the very last sentence, where the people of Israel say this to each other, lay it to your hearts, speak to each other's hearts, take some counsel, and say what we're to do. See how that underscores that motif. Now, of course, the major motif that runs through the entire story, besides what we've been looking at, the woman herself, is the whole question of hospitality. See, it runs around this incredibly strong motif in all of the Eastern cultures of hospitality. In the Eastern cultures, you're supposed to take someone in even if he's a stranger, even if she's an enemy. If that person comes seeking aid from you and comes into your home, you're to protect that person at all costs, even if you find out that it's an enemy. But Tribble says, according to this story, evidently that only counts if you're a man. If you're property, like asses and women and slaves, it doesn't count for you. And so that whole business that goes on back and forth about the door and the doorway and the threshold of the doorway and the outside and the inside, you know, and the poor concubine, you know, she's sort of like just pushed back and forth over this threshold. The rules of hospitality don't really seem to apply to her. So in the first scene, the great familial reconciliation is not between the Levite and his concubine, it's between the Levite and her father. They're the ones who have the party for 3 days and a fourth day and a little bit more.
I feel like either this whole thing drove him crazy or he was crazy to start out with.
Why she went back to her father?
Yeah.
He gave her up to sacrifice to save yeah. himself.
Oh, sure. He gives her up to sacrifice himself. And you can do it if it's a non-person. See, it appears to me this raises that whole question. See, when you're talking about hospitality, finally, you get to a question that Jesus asked in that parable about the Good Samaritan, to which Tribble alluded. The question finally comes out, you know, you ask the question, who is my neighbor? But the parable never answers that question. It never answers who your neighbor is. The question becomes, are you the neighbor? Do you do the neighborly thing? Jesus at the end of the parable says, which one proved to be neighbor? The question gets turned the other way around. And the old man is trying to be hospitable, but when the crunch comes, he's the first one who says, take his concubine. Take my daughter. She's a virgin. Whichever one you want, but don't do anything to this man here. This would be terrible. And while they're still even negotiating this, the Levite simply pushes. He seizes her and gives a push outside. So much for hospitality. Yeah, the sign of where safety lay if she could have gotten over. Yeah. Then, of course, you also have the reversal. He didn't want to go into a foreign city because he didn't think he'd get hospitality there. So he goes to his own fellow Israelites, and precisely there, he doesn't get hospitality. There's an aside that I need to make, and Tribble talks to some extent about this on pages 74 and 75, and a little bit on the top of 76, and that is, I'm sure many of you notice, the striking parallel between this story and the one that all of us know back in Genesis, the story of Sodom, where Lot is the sojourner, and the men of the city come, and they want to have their way with Lot. And you remember in that story, he gets protected, because doesn't the heavenly messenger come and strike them with blindness or something, and See, Lot gets saved. You know, one asks the question, you know, why does the God step in for him and there's no God to step in for this concubine? Another aside, both of these stories have been used as an excuse for the oppression, the persecution, and the perpetrating of all kinds of violence against homosexuals. Yet the story basically has absolutely nothing to do with homosexuality. I mean, they're hardly homosexuals if they're more than willing to take a virgin daughter or a concubine in place of the man.
But there are other instances where the Benjaminites were called left-handed homosexuals.
Where the Benjaminites are?
Left-handed someplace.
I'd enjoy seeing that one. I'm not aware of that one.
Well, he had that crossface.
Is that right?
It's a very strange twist because that's the question I'm raised here, you see.
I'd insist that the story is not about homosexuality.
Well,
it's about rape.
But they wanted him.
Well, sure they do. Now the question is, why did they want to?
But the Benjaminites were the homosexual involvement.
Now.
And left-handed.
All right.
I can't document this.
The activity would have been a homosexual activity. It would have been between men, right? But it's not homosexuality. It appears pretty plain to me that what they're trying to do is humiliate the man. And we know this in many cultures. This is one way that when you come in as strangers, you get put in your place. What happens to young men when they enter prisons in our own society? You mean to tell me that we have all of a sudden these people suddenly become homosexuals when they go into prison? No, it's a way of insulting, of putting a person down, putting him in his place. What it is simply violence. And I think that's terribly important. The story is about violence. It's about rape. It's about forcing someone to do something, you know, that the other person obviously doesn't want to do. And it's interesting because in the New Testament, when Sodom and Gomorrah are mentioned, there's a couple places in the epistle, the emphasis is that they were not hospitable. They didn't keep the rules of hospitality. That was the sin of Sodom. And that's clearly what's going on here. And I think that people who want to use this story, or the one in Genesis, as an excuse, you know, for the persecuting of homosexuals, have absolutely no foot to stand on out of either of these stories. Because they simply don't speak to homosexuality. They certainly don't talk to homosexual love and care and relationship. There's no love in the story at all. There's no care anywhere. There's no relationship anywhere. What it is an abuse of persons. Whether it's a male they're going to abuse, and if they can't get him, okay, then we'll take a female. What's the difference? They don't care one way or the other. Whoever they can abuse, they abuse. Sometimes this is done to POWs in societies, too. Put them in their place very soon. Please, Carol.
I see a tremendous irony, and I first picked this up in seminary and in another context, but you mentioned it here today and brought it up as an irony in the story, and that is that there's always mention of the Hebrew verb to know as having a sexual implication as well as a sexual meaning as well as intellectual meaning.
Yeah.
And it seems to me a great irony that, of course, that is not what makes people know a woman or a man. That, in fact, if he had spoken kindly to her,
from the heart,
to her heart, that seems to me that there is more knowing in real communication that instead this knowing of the woman is not knowing her at all.
Yeah.
I just heard that an awful lot and finally I thought, what makes people think that that's knowing?
Yeah, there's obviously a lot more to knowing than just that.
Yeah.
It's obviously one way of saying that you've got intimacy and supposedly you're not hiding anything from each other, but all of us know how well you can use the most intimate of activities to do lots of hiding.
Yeah.
depending on the situation.
He knew her father.
Yeah, better than he knew her.
But I mean, he knew her father in conversation and in almost party celebration.
Yeah. There's an awful sequel to the story as well, and that is, as you go on, Tribble, in the last part of her chapter here, talks about responses to the story. And, of course, the immediate response in the story is that they first go out to slaughter all the Benjaminites for perpetrating this, then they change their mind, and they end up, you know, seizing 400 women from one village, where they do some more slaughtering, 200 women from a festival and carry them off, so you end up with 600 more rapes, innumerable deaths and violence and destruction all over the place. It's almost unmitigated violence. And in a sense, what happens is that the concubine story gets lost into the editor's greater concern, which is to show things were really Wild West-like in the days of the judges. It's about time we had a king. It's all subordinated to political interests. And so one more way of just sort of taking her, whatever personality she might have had, and, you know, just shoving it aside.